Back to our old house in Berlin. Would you like that?
Bruno thought about it. Well, I wouldn't like it if you weren't there, he said, because that was the truth.
So you'd prefer to stay here with me?
I'd prefer all four of us to stay together, he said, reluctantly, including Gretel in that. Whether that was in Berlin or Outwith.
Oh, Bruno, said Gretel in an exasperated voice, and he didn't know whether that was because he might be spoiling the plans for their return, or because, according to her, he continued to mispronounce the name of their home.
Well, for the moment I'm afraid that's going to be impossible, said Father. I'm afraid that the Fury will not relieve me of my command just yet. Mother, on the other hand, thinks this would be a good time for the three of you to return home and reopen the house. And when I think about it...
He paused for a moment and looked out at the window to his left, the window that led off to a view of the camp on the other side of the fence.
When I think about it, perhaps she is right. Perhaps this is not a place for children.
There are hundreds of children here, said Bruno, without really thinking about his words before saying them. Only they're on the other side of the fence.
A silence followed this remark. But it wasn't like a normal silence where it just happens that no one is talking. It was like a silence that was very noisy. Father and Gretel stared at him, and he blinked in surprise.
What do you mean there are hundreds of children over there? Asked Father. What do you know of what goes on over there?
Bruno opened his mouth to speak, but worried that he would get himself into trouble if he revealed too much.
I can see them from my bedroom window, he said finally. They're very far away, of course, but it looks like there are hundreds, all wearing the striped pyjamas.
The striped pyjamas, yes, said Father, nodding his head. And you've been watching, have you?
Well, I've seen them, said Bruno. I'm not sure if that's the same thing.
Father smiled.
Very good, Bruno, he said. And you're right. It's not quite the same thing.
He hesitated again, and then nodded his head, as if he had made a final decision.
No, she's right,
he said, speaking out loud, but not looking at either Gretel or Bruno.
She's absolutely right. You've been here long enough as it is. It's time for you to go home.
And so the decision was made. Word was sent ahead that the house should be cleaned, the windows washed, the banister varnished, the linen pressed, the beds made, and Father announced that Mother, Gretel, and Bruno would be returning to Berlin within the week. Bruno found that he was not looking forward to this as much as he would have expected, and he dreaded having to tell Shmuel the news. Chapter 18. Thinking Up the Final Adventure. The day after Father told Bruno that he would be returning to Berlin soon, Shmuel didn't arrive at the fence as usual. Nor did he show up the day after that. On the third day when Bruno arrived, there was no one sitting cross-legged on the ground, and he waited for 10 minutes and was about to turn back for home, extremely worried that he would have to leave Outwith without seeing his friend again, when a dot in the distance became a speck, and that became a blob, and that became a figure, and that in turn became the boy in the striped pyjamas. Bruno broke into a smile when he saw the figure coming towards him, and he sat down on the ground, taking the piece of bread and the apple he had smuggled with him out of his pocket to give to Shmuel. But even from a distance he could see that his friend looked even more unhappy than usual, and when he got to the fence he didn't reach for the food with his usual eagerness.
I thought you weren't coming any more, said Bruno. I came yesterday and the day before that, and you weren't here.
I'm sorry, said Shmuel. Something happened. Bruno looked at him and narrowed his eyes, trying to guess what it might be. He wondered whether Shmuel had been told that he was going home too. After all, coincidences like that do happen, such as the fact that Bruno and Shmuel shared the same birthday.
Well, asked Bruno, what was it?
Papa, said Shmuel. We can't find him.
Can't find him?
That's very odd. You mean he's lost?
I suppose so, said Shmuel. He was here on Monday, and then he went on work duty with some other men, and none of them have come back.
And hasn't he written you a letter, asked Bruno, or left a note to say when he'll be coming back?
No, said Shmuel.
How odd, said Bruno. Have you looked for him? He asked after a moment.
Of course I have, said Shmuel with a sigh. I did what you're always talking about. I did some exploration.
And there was no sign?
None.
Well, that's very strange, said Bruno. But I think there must be a simple explanation.
And what's that? Asked Shmuel.
I imagine the men were taken to work in another town, and they have to stay there for a few days until the work is done, and the post isn't very good here anyway. I expect he'll turn up one day soon.
I hope so, said Shmuel, who looked as if he was about to cry. I don't know what we're supposed to do without him.
I could ask Father if you wanted, said Bruno cautiously, hoping that Shmuel wouldn't say yes.
I don't think that would be a good idea, said Shmuel,
which to Bruno's disappointment was not a flat-out rejection of the offer.
Why not? He asked.
Father is very knowledgeable about life on that side of the fence.
I don't think the soldiers like us, said Shmuel. Well, he added with something as close to a laugh as he could muster, I know they don't like us. They hate us.
Bruno sat back in surprise. I'm sure they don't hate you, he said.
They do, said Shmuel, leaning forward, his eyes narrowing and his lips curling up a little in anger. But that's all right, because I hate them too. I hate them, he repeated forcefully. You don't hate Father, do you? Asked Bruno.
Shmuel bit his lip and said nothing. He had seen Bruno's father on any number of occasions and couldn't understand how such a man could have a son who was so friendly and kind.
Anyway, said Bruno after a suitable pause, not wishing to discuss that topic any further, I have something to tell you too.
You do? Asked Shmuel, looking up hopefully.
Yes. I'm going back to Berlin.
Shmuel's mouth dropped open in surprise.
When?
He asked, his voice catching slightly in his throat as he did so.
Well, this is Thursday, said Bruno, and we're leaving on Saturday, after lunch.
But for how long? Asked Shmuel.
I think it's forever, said Bruno.
Mother doesn't like it at Outwith. She says it's no place to bring up two children. So Father is staying here to work because the Fuhrer has big things in mind for him, but the rest of us are going home.
He said the word home, despite the fact that he wasn't sure where home was anymore.
So I won't see you again? Asked Shmuel.
Well, some day, yes, said Bruno. You could come on a holiday to Berlin. You can't stay here forever, after all, can you?
Shmuel shook his head.
I suppose not, he said sadly. I won't have anyone to talk to any more when you're gone, he added.
No, said Bruno. He wanted to add the words, I'll miss you too, Shmuel, to the sentence, but found that he was a little embarrassed to say them.
So tomorrow will be the last time we see each other until then, he continued. We'll have to say our goodbyes then. I'll try to bring you an extra special treat.
Shmuel nodded, but couldn't find any words to express his sorrow.
I wish we'd got to play together, said Bruno after a long pause. Just once. Just to remember.
So do I, said Shmuel. We've been talking to each other for more than a year, and we never got to play once. And do you know what else? He added. All this time I've been watching where you live from out of my bedroom window, and I've never even seen for myself what it's like.
You wouldn't like it, said Shmuel. Yours is much nicer, he added.
I'd still like to have seen it, said Bruno.
Shmuel thought for a few moments, and then reached down and put his hand under the fence and lifted it a little to the height where a small boy, perhaps the size and shape of Bruno, could fit underneath.
Well, said Shmuel, why don't you then?
Bruno blinked and thought about it.
I don't think I'd be allowed, he said doubtfully.
Well, you're probably not allowed to come here and talk to me every day either, said Shmuel. But you still do it, don't you?
But if I was caught, I'd be in trouble, said Bruno, who was sure Mother and Father would not approve.
That's true, said Shmuel, lowering the fence again and looking at the ground with tears in his eyes. I suppose I'll see you tomorrow to say goodbye, then.
Neither boy said anything for a moment. Suddenly Bruno had a brainwave.
Unless, he began, thinking about it for a moment and allowing a plan to hatch in his head. He reached a hand up to his head and felt where his hair used to be, but was now just stubble that hadn't fully grown back. Don't you remember that you said I looked like you, he asked Shmuel, since I had my head shaved?
Only fatter, conceded Shmuel.
Well, if that's the case, said Bruno, and if I had a pair of striped pajamas too, then I could come over on a visit and no one would be any the wiser.
Shmuel's face brightened up and he broke into a wide smile.
Do you think so? He asked. Would you do it? Of course, said Bruno. It would be a great adventure. Our final adventure. I could do some exploring at last.
And you could help me look for Papa, said Shmuel.
Why not? Said Bruno. We'll take a walk around and see whether we can find any evidence. That's always wise when you're exploring. The only problem is getting a spare pair of striped pajamas.
Shmuel shook his head.
That's all right, he said. There's a hut where they keep them. I can get some in my size and bring them with me. Then you can change, and we can look for Papa.
Wonderful, said Bruno, caught up in the enthusiasm of the moment. Then it's a plan.
We'll meet at the same time tomorrow, said Shmuel.
Don't be late this time, said Bruno, standing up and dusting himself down. And don't forget the striped pajamas.
Both boys went home in high spirits that afternoon. Bruno imagined a great adventure ahead, and finally an opportunity to see what was really on the other side of the fence before he went back to Berlin, not to mention getting in a little serious exploration as well. And Shmuel saw a chance to get someone to help him in the search for his papa. All in all, it seemed like a very sensible plan, and a good way to say goodbye.
Chapter 19. What happened the next day? The next day, Friday, was another wet day. When Bruno woke in the morning, he looked out of his window and was disappointed to see the rain pouring down. Had it not been for the fact that it would be the last chance for him and Shmuel to spend any time together, not to mention the fact that the adventure would be a very exciting one, especially since it involved dressing up, he would have given up on it for the day and waited until some afternoon the following week when he didn't have anything special planned. However, the clock was ticking, and there was nothing he could do about it, and after all, it was only the morning, and a lot could happen between then and the late afternoon, which was when the two boys always met. The rain would surely have stopped by then. He watched out of the window during morning classes with Herr List, but it showed no signs of slowing down then, and even pounded noisily against the window. He watched during lunch from the kitchen, when it was definitely starting to ease off, and there was even the hint of sunshine coming from behind a black cloud. He watched during history and geography lessons in the afternoon, when it reached its strongest force yet, and threatened to knock the window in. Fortunately, it came to an end around the time that Herr List was leaving, and so Bruno put on a pair of boots and his heavy raincoat, waited until the coast was clear, and left the house. His boots squelched in the mud, and he started to enjoy the walk more than he ever had before. With every step, he seemed to face the danger of toppling over and falling down, but he never did, and managed to keep his balance, even at a particularly bad part where, when he lifted his left leg, his boot stayed implanted in the mud while his foot slipped right out of it. He looked up at the skies, and although they were still very dark, he thought the day had probably had enough rain, and he would be safe enough this afternoon. Of course, there would be the difficulty of explaining why he was so filthy later on when he returned home, but he could put that down to being a typical boy, which was what Mother claimed he was, and probably not get into too much trouble. Mother had been particularly happy over the previous few days, as each box of their belongings had been sealed and packed into a truck for dispatch to Berlin. Shmuel was waiting for Bruno when he arrived, and for the first time ever he wasn't sitting cross-legged on the ground and staring at the dust beneath him, but standing, leaning against the fence.
"Hello, Bruno," he said when he saw his friend approaching. "Hello, Shmuel," said Bruno. "I wasn't sure if we'd ever see each other again, with the rain and everything, I mean," said Shmuel. "I thought you might be kept indoors."
It was touch and go for a while, said Bruno. What with the weather being so bad?
Shmuel nodded and held out his hands to Bruno, who opened his mouth in delight. He was carrying a pair of striped pajama bottoms, a striped pajama top, and a striped cloth cap exactly like the one he was wearing. It didn't look particularly clean, but it was a disguise, and Bruno knew that good explorers always wore the right clothes.
You still want to help me find Papa, asked Shmuel,
and Bruno nodded quickly.
Of course, he said,
although finding Shmuel's Papa was not as important in his mind as the prospect of exploring the world on the other side of the fence.
I wouldn't let you down.
Shmuel lifted the bottom of the fence off the ground and handed the outfit underneath to Bruno, being particularly careful not to let it touch the muddy ground below.
Thanks, said Bruno, scratching his stubbly head and wondering why he hadn't remembered to bring a bag to hold his own clothes in. The ground was so dirty here that they would be spoiled if he left them on the ground.
He didn't have a choice, really. He could either leave them here until later and accept the fact that they would be entirely caked with mud, or he could call the whole thing off, and that, as any explorer of note knows, would have been out of the question.
Well, turn round, said Bruno, pointing at his friend as he stood there awkwardly. I don't want you watching me.
Shmuel turned round, and Bruno took off his overcoat and placed it as gently as possible on the ground. Then he took off his shirt and shivered for a moment in the cold air before putting on the pajama top. As it slipped over his head, he made the mistake of breathing through his nose. It did not smell very nice.
When was this last washed?
He called out, and Shmuel turned round.
I don't know if it's ever been washed, said Shmuel. Turn round, shouted Bruno,
and Shmuel did as he was told. Bruno looked left and right again, but there was still no one to be seen, so he began the difficult task of taking off his trousers while keeping one leg and one boot on the ground at the same time. It felt very strange taking off his trousers in the open air, and he couldn't imagine what anyone would think if they saw him doing it. But finally, and with a great deal of effort, he managed to complete the task.
There, he said. You can turn back now.
Shmuel turned just as Bruno applied the finishing touch to his costume, placing the striped cloth cap on his head. Shmuel blinked and shook his head. It was quite extraordinary. If it wasn't for the fact that Bruno was nowhere near as skinny as the boys on his side of the fence, and not quite so pale either, it would have been difficult to tell them apart. It was almost, Shmuel thought, as if they were all exactly the same, really.
Do you know what this reminds me of?
Asked Bruno, and Shmuel shook his head.
What?
He asked.
It reminds me of Grandmother, he said. You remember I told you about her? The one who died?
Shmuel nodded. He remembered because Bruno had talked about her a lot over the course of the year, and had told him how fond he had been of Grandmother, and how he wished he'd taken the time to write more letters to her before she passed away.
It reminds me of the play she used to put on with Gretel and me, Bruno said, looking away from Shmuel as he remembered those days back in Berlin. Part of the very few memories now that refuse to fade. It reminds me of how she always had the right costume for me to wear. You wear the right outfit, and you feel like the person you're pretending to be, she always told me. I suppose that's what I'm doing, isn't it? Pretending to be a person from the other side of the fence.
A Jew, you mean, said Shmuel.
Yes,
said Bruno, shifting on his feet a little uncomfortably.
That's right.
Shmuel pointed at Bruno's feet and the heavy boots he had taken from the house.
You'll have to leave them behind too, he said.
Bruno looked appalled.
But the mud, he said, you can't expect me to go barefoot. You'll be recognized otherwise, said Shmuel. You don't have any choice.
Bruno sighed, but he knew that his friend was right, and he took off the boots and his socks and left them beside the pile of clothes on the ground. At first it felt horrible putting his bare feet into so much mud. They sank down to his ankles, and every time he lifted a foot it felt worse. But then he started to rather enjoy it. Shmuel reached down and lifted the base of the fence, but it only lifted to a certain height, and Bruno had no choice but to roll under it, getting his striped pajamas completely covered in mud as he did so. He laughed when he looked down at himself. He had never been so filthy in all his life, and it felt wonderful. Shmuel smiled too, and the two boys stood awkwardly together for a moment, unaccustomed to being on the same side of the fence. Bruno had an urge to give Shmuel a hug, just to let him know how much he liked him and how much he'd enjoyed talking to him over the last year. Shmuel had an urge to give Bruno a hug too, just to thank him for all his many kindnesses and his gifts of food, and the fact that he was going to help him find Papa. Neither of them did hug each other, though, and instead they began the walk away from the fence and towards the camp, a walk that Shmuel had done almost every day for a year now, when he had escaped the eyes of the soldiers and managed to get to that one part of Outwith that didn't seem to be guarded all the time, a place where he had been lucky enough to meet a friend like Bruno. It didn't take long to get where they were going. Bruno opened his eyes in wonder at the things he saw. In his imagination, he had thought that all the huts were full of happy families, some of whom sat outside on rocking chairs in the evening and told stories about how things were so much better when they were children and they'd had respect for their elders, not like the children nowadays. He thought that all the boys and girls who lived here would be in different groups, playing tennis or football, skipping and drawing out squares for hopscotch on the ground. He had thought that there would be a shop in the center, and maybe a small cafe like the ones he had known in Berlin. He had wondered whether there would be a fruit and vegetable store. As it turned out, all the things that he thought might be there weren't. There were no grown-ups sitting on rocking chairs on their porches, and the children weren't playing games in groups. And not only was there not a fruit and vegetable store, but there wasn't a cafe either, like there had been back in Berlin. Instead, there were crowds of people sitting together in groups, staring at the ground, looking horribly sad. They all had one thing in common. They were all terribly skinny, and their eyes were sunken, and they all had shaved heads, which Bruno thought must have meant there had been an outbreak of lice here too. In one corner, Bruno could see three soldiers who seemed to be in charge of a group of about 20 men. They were shouting at them, and some of the men had fallen to their knees and were remaining there with their heads in their hands. In another corner, he could see more soldiers standing around and laughing and looking down the barrels of their guns, aiming them in random directions but not firing them. In fact, everywhere he looked, all he could see was two different types of people, either happy, laughing, shouting soldiers in their uniforms, or unhappy, crying people in their striped pajamas, most of whom seemed to be staring into space as if they were actually asleep. "I don't think I like it here," said Bruno after a while.
"Neither do I," said Shmuel.
"I think I ought to go home," said Bruno. Shmuel stopped walking and stared at him.
"But Papa," he said, "you said you'd help me find him."
Bruno thought about it. He had promised his friend that, and he wasn't the sort to go back on a promise, especially when it was the last time they were going to see each other. "All right," he said, although he felt a lot less confident now than he had before. "But where should we look?"
"You said we'd need to find evidence," said Shmuel, who was feeling upset because he thought that if Bruno didn't help him, then who would?
"Evidence, yes," said Bruno, nodding his head. "You're right. Let's start looking." So Bruno kept his word, and the two boys spent an hour and a half searching the camp looking for evidence. They weren't sure exactly what they were looking for, but Bruno kept stating that a good explorer would know it when he found it. But they didn't find anything at all that might give them a clue to Shmuel's Papa's disappearance, and it started to get darker. Bruno looked up at the sky, and it looked like it might rain again.
"I'm sorry, Shmuel," he said eventually. "I'm sorry we didn't find any evidence."
Shmuel nodded his head sadly. He wasn't really surprised. He hadn't really expected to. But it had been nice having his friend over to see where he lived all the same.
"I think I ought to go home now," said Bruno. "Will you walk back to the fence with me?"
Shmuel opened his mouth to answer, but right at that moment there was a loud whistle, and 10 soldiers, more than Bruno had ever seen gathered together in one place before, surrounded an area of the camp, the area in which Bruno and Shmuel were standing.
"What's happening?" whispered Bruno. "What's going on?"
"It happens sometimes," said Shmuel. "They make people go on marches."
"Marches?" said Bruno, appalled. "I can't go on a march. I have to be home in time for dinner. It's roast beef tonight."
"Shh," said Shmuel, putting a finger to his lips. "Don't say anything, or they get angry."
Bruno frowned, but was relieved that all the people in striped pajamas from this part of the camp were gathering together now, most of them being pushed together by the soldiers, so that he and Shmuel were hidden in the center of them and couldn't be seen. He didn't know what everyone looked so frightened about. After all, marching wasn't such a terrible thing, and he wanted to whisper to them that everything was all right, that Father was the commandant, and if this was the kind of thing that he wanted the people to do, then it must be all right. The whistles blew again, and this time the group of people, which must have numbered about 100, started to march slowly together, with Bruno and Shmuel still held together in the center. There was some sort of disturbance towards the back, where some people seemed unwilling to march. But Bruno was too small to see what happened, and all he heard was loud noises like the sound of gunshots, but he couldn't make out what they were. "Does the marching go on for long?" he whispered, because he was beginning to feel quite hungry now. "I don't think so," said Shmuel. "I never see the people after they've gone on a march, but I wouldn't imagine it does." Bruno frowned. He looked up at the sky, and as he did so there was another loud sound, this time the sound of thunder overhead, and just as quickly the sky seemed to grow even darker, almost black, and rain poured down even more heavily than it had in the morning. Bruno closed his eyes for a moment and felt it wash over him. When he opened them again, he wasn't so much marching as being swept along by the group of people, and all he could feel was the mud that was caked all over his body and his pajamas clinging to his skin with all the rain, and he longed to be back in his house, watching all this from a distance and not wrapped up in the center of it. "That's it," he said to Shmuel. "I'm going to catch a cold out here. I have to go home." But just as he said this, his feet brought him up a set of steps. And as he marched on, he found there was no more rain coming down anymore because they were all piling into a long room that was surprisingly warm and must have been very securely built because no rain was getting in anywhere. In fact, it felt completely airtight. "Well, that's something," he said, glad to be out of the storm for a few minutes at least. "I expect we'll have to wait here till it eases off, and then I'll get to go home." Shmuel gathered himself very close to Bruno and looked up at him in fright. "I'm sorry we didn't find your papa," said Bruno. "It's all right," said Shmuel. "And I'm sorry we didn't really get to play. But when you come to Berlin, that's what we'll do, and I'll introduce you to..." "Oh, what were their names again?" he asked himself, frustrated because they were supposed to be his three best friends for life. But they had all vanished from his memory now. He couldn't remember any of their names, and he couldn't picture any of their faces. "Actually," he said, looking down at Shmuel, "it doesn't matter whether I do or don't. They're not my best friends anymore anyway." He looked down and did something quite out of character for him. He took hold of Shmuel's tiny hand in his and squeezed it tightly. "You're my best friend, Shmuel," he said. "My best friend for life." Shmuel may well have opened his mouth to say something back, but Bruno never heard it because at that moment there was a loud gasp from all the marchers who had filled the room, as the door at the front was suddenly closed, and a loud metallic sound rang through from the outside. Bruno raised an eyebrow, unable to understand the sense of all this, but he assumed that it had something to do with keeping the rain out and stopping people from catching cold. And then the room went very dark, and somehow, despite the chaos that followed, Bruno found that he was still holding Shmuel's hand in his own. And nothing in the world would have persuaded him to let it go. Chapter 20. The last chapter. Nothing more was ever heard of Bruno after that. Several days later, after the soldiers had searched every part of the house and gone into all the local towns and villages with pictures of the little boy, one of them discovered the pile of clothes and the pair of boots that Bruno had left near the fence. He left them there, undisturbed, and went to fetch the commandant to examine the area and look to his left and look to his right just as Bruno had done, but for the life of him he could not understand what had happened to his son. It was as if he had just vanished off the face of the earth and left his clothes behind him. Mother did not return to Berlin quite as quickly as she had hoped. She stayed at Auschwitz for several months, waiting for news of Bruno until one day, quite suddenly, she thought he might have made his way home alone. So she immediately returned to their old house, half expecting to see him sitting on the doorstep waiting for her. He wasn't there, of course. Gretel returned to Berlin with Mother and spent a lot of time alone in her room crying, not because she had thrown her dolls away, and not because she had left all her maps behind at Auschwitz, but because she missed Bruno so much. Father stayed at Auschwitz for another year after that, and became very disliked by the other soldiers, whom he ordered around mercilessly. He went to sleep every night thinking about Bruno, and he woke up every morning thinking about him too. One day he formed a theory about what might have occurred, and he went back to the place in the fence where the pile of clothes had been found a year before. There was nothing particularly special about this place, or different. But then he did a little exploration of his own and discovered that the base of the fence here was not properly attached to the ground as it was everywhere else, and that when lifted, it left a gap large enough for a very small person, such as a little boy, to crawl underneath. He looked into the distance then and followed it through logically, step by step by step. And when he did, he found that his legs seemed to stop working right, as if they couldn't hold his body up any longer. And he ended up sitting on the ground in almost exactly the same position as Bruno had every afternoon for a year, although he didn't cross his legs beneath him. A few months after that, some other soldiers came to Auschwitz, and Father was ordered to go with them. And he went without complaint, and he was happy to do so because he didn't really mind what they did to him anymore. And that's the end of the story about Bruno and his family. Of course, all this happened a long time ago, and nothing like that could ever happen again. Not in this day and age.
Hello. I am David Fickling. I am the editor and the publisher, the original publisher of The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, and very proud to be so. And today I'm here talking to John Boyne, the author.
Hi, David.
Well, we published in January, and I have to say we've had an astonishing response to this book. It's one of those books that seems to have gone out and hit readers right in the solar plexus and created a response, sometimes emotionally overwhelming. This is sort of borne up by the fact that the book has been number one on the Irish bestseller list, number one in Australia, up to number four in the UK, and there are publishing plans for a number of foreign editions. How many foreign editions,
15,
John?
At the moment.
15 and rising, probably. The one kind of response we've been getting is, as I say, an overwhelming emotional response, just like I felt when I first read the book, that it is very moving. But as sort of against that sort of 95% of positive response, there's been also a sort of 5% of very critical, angry response to this book, John. Have you come across that?
Yeah, I have. I mean, since the book was published, I've attended quite a number of literary festivals and done quite a few readings and a book tour and met with readers of this book. And this is a book which is aimed at as many readers as possible, and been able to get their response on the front line as such in bookshops and at events that I've done, also in the letters and emails they've sent me. Now, I expected a reaction to this
book. We both did, didn't we?
Yeah, and I hoped, obviously, that it would be positive. And it has been more positive than negative. But I did expect to have some people who would have as extreme an antipathy towards the book as there have been people who have an extreme passion for the book. And I think that's understandable in a way. But I've enjoyed the process of meeting people and hearing what their problems are with the book and really putting my as the author of the book, putting my idea to them and saying, this is where I'm coming from in writing this book. You can agree with me or disagree with me, but let's talk about it.
It seems to me that the main criticism, and criticism is almost too soft a word, there's sort of anger here as well, but the main criticism has been that Bruno, the hero and carrier of the book, is just too naive, that it's unbelievable that Bruno could put himself in the position that he did, and what happened to Bruno could happen.
It is the question I've probably been asked the most in relation to the book about Bruno's innocence. Originally, when writing the book, one of my ideas was I knew I was dealing with an extreme of evil in the subject of the Holocaust, and I was interested in juxtaposing that with an extreme of innocence, how the two would go together. Now, of course, in deciding to do that, I realised that there would be a possibility in the book that people would look at Bruno, this 9-year-old child who seems at times to be so ignorant about what's going on around him, and say, well, how could that be? Now, I have two answers to that. The first one would be that I think readers today, we look at books from the position of hindsight. We're reading books from a 21st century point of view, with all that we've read about a subject, all we've seen in movies, all we've heard on the news. And we expect that everybody always knew what we know now. And that's not the case. When these concentration camps were liberated in 1945 by the Allies, and news of what went on there started to spread around the world through 45 and through 46, people were shocked, is too small a word, people were amazed that such a thing could possibly happen in then the mid-20th century. Now we look at that situation and we all know that that happened.
We all know about it.
Yeah, but people didn't know about it then. It was shocking and it was appalling. So to expect that a 9-year-old child who has been very sheltered in his life, has lived within a family group which really only socialises within a particular sect of that society, to expect that a 9-year-old child would in fact be aware of all these things while they were happening in the way that the rest of the world wasn't, I think is probably something that is fair to consider when it comes to Bruno. But also there is another point on this, which is to do with the complacency of people during the late 30s and the 1940s. One of the reasons why the Holocaust happened, one of the reasons why Holocausts continue to happen throughout the world in the years in between, is through the complacency of people who sit by, watch these things going on and do nothing about it. In my research about Auschwitz, for example, I read about how groups of people would be walked from the camp in their inmate uniforms, emaciated, dying, struggling to walk, walked through local villages where people lived in order to get water, in order to get wood, and no one did anything. One of the big questions and one of the big facts about the Holocaust is that so many people just were complacent and didn't do anything. It's what were called Hitler's willing executioners, people who sat by and did nothing. It raises the question of, if we were there at that time, would we all have stood up and done something? You'd like to think you would have. Would you have? That's a question that people have to ask us themselves. And I think when it comes to Bruno, Bruno is as complacent as everybody else was at that time. Mm. Plus he's a 9-year-old.
When I first read it, I read it from Bruno's point of view, and I was willingly accepting Bruno's point of view, because that sense of an innocent 9-year-old seems to me totally real. And I didn't want to question any of the historical factors about it, because I was struck by the originality of looking at it from the German point of view, the unknowing German point of view, not necessarily complacent, but just ignorant.
What you refer to as the German point of view, I actually refer to as my point of view, because it takes the form of a child outside the fence who doesn't know what's going on inside, who's looking across and seeing these people and saying, what's going on there? Why is it happening? Now, as a relatively young person living today and thinking about these subject matters, that's the only position I felt I could place myself in, from the outside, looking through the fence, wondering what's going on over there and why is it happening. Yes, the main protagonist is a little German boy, which perhaps hasn't been explored before in fiction. But I think that's a small point compared to the fact that that is where we today are looking at this from. And it's only those people who went through the situation or who lost people in those camps who can really place themselves within. And as a writer, I did not feel I wanted to place myself within the camp. I didn't feel I had a right to do that. I did feel I had a right to stand outside the fence and look inside.
Can I ask you, have you had responses from survivors who have read the book, or people who are actually involved with the camps?
I have. I've received quite a number of letters and emails since the book was published from people, mostly from people who perhaps lost a parent or an uncle or an aunt or a relative in the camp, more so than actual people who were there themselves. But I have received letters from grandparents, for example, who have written to me to tell me they were moved by the story and want to give the book to their grandchildren as a way of introducing this subject matter to them and opening up a discussion with them about it. I had a letter from a lady who was bringing her grandchildren to Belsen later on in the year, and she was saying this was how she was going to actually start the conversation with them about this. I mean, I'm under no illusions that when it comes to children reading this book, this is only a starting point. This is the kind of book, I think, which when children get to the end of reading it, they will want to ask questions and want to know more and really go on to read those more powerful books written by people like Primo Levi, for example. This is a start for children reading this, I think. I guess I hope that they will relate to these children so much, relate to Bruno and relate to Shmuel, and be sufficiently moved by their plight and their ultimate fate that they will want to stand up and say, why? Why did that happen?
One criticism I've heard that because Bruno could get into the camp so easily, it would be simple for people to walk out. Isn't this encouraging an unreal sense of the camps?
I've said all along that I made certain decisions in writing this book which I felt were important for the narrative and changed certain facts of the camps in order to be able to tell the story, such as putting the house outside the fence in order that Bruno would be able to walk to the fence and have his conversations with Shmuel, and such as having that one place in the fence that would lift up, that they would be able to pass food to each other and pass under the fence at a crucial point in the story. Now, personally, I think that's justifiable. This isn't a historical tract and it's not a political tract. It's a novel. It's a story based at a terrible place at a terrible time. And the important thing to me was to keep the integrity and honesty of the emotions that these boys would go through and to tell a story of this place without trivializing it, while always trying to remain sensitive to it, but also knowing that I'm telling a story. Now, we made a decision between us, David, to use the phrase at the start of the book, a fable.
Yes.
And in some way, I come back to that when I'm asked a question about how is it that the one place in the fence that lifts up is the one place they happen to be sitting at. Well, you know, that's what happens in a novel, really. That's what happens in a story.
We did agree to put a fable on, and I was concerned as an editor and a publisher to put that on so that it wasn't going to be mistaken for a factual, historical book, but it is the story of Bruno,
yes,
a 9-year-old boy. And any story requires the willing suspension of disbelief. The emphasis is on the word willing. And if I was asked the question, couldn't people just walk out? The sense of this story is like a nightmare. The more you know about the Holocaust, the more it's like a nightmare. I think the direction of the story is only one way. I read it knowing some things about the Holocaust, by no means being incredibly well read on it, but I could feel what was coming, and that didn't spoil it for me in any sense. In fact, I think it enhanced it, made it more powerful. I think the older you are, the more you know, the more this story will have power.
In a way, it's a frustrating thing when someone gets to the end of this book and has gone on this journey with these two boys and explored this subject matter and comes away from it saying, well, how could this have happened? And how could this have happened? It seems to be trivializing the moral center of the book, which is a story about these boys in this terrible place.
The Holocaust is such an abominable and unthinkable historical event that there is a certain mindset which thinks of it as something that can't be touched or written about, or shouldn't be written about, apart from somebody was there.
To a point, I actually agree with Eli Wiesel's phrase that if you weren't there, don't write about it. I think it's probably a sensible enough thing to say, even though I have written about it. And one of the things I think is that if someone comes away from this book wanting to pick at these little points that we bring up and ignore the bigger questions that this novel raises, then I think that's doing the kind of trivializing of the subject matter that I hoped to avoid. Now, if somebody came away from the book and felt that I had been insensitive to it, then I think I would say, all right, that's a reason to criticize, and that's a reason to put the book down and step away from it.
If you'd set the book in Rwanda or somewhere else, do you think you'd have had the same response?
I don't think so. No, I don't. You'd like to think that you could, because every life is worth the same and every inexcusable death is as inexcusable as every other one. So there's no reason why not. We're told time and time again, you know, not to forget these stories, to keep talking about them. The reason the Shoah Institute exists is to record the testimonies of people now while they're still with us, so that these stories never get forgotten.
Where did this come from, John? You know, because I felt literally dumbstruck by the book. So where did such a thing come from? How did it come to you as a writer?
It came to me originally as one single image of two boys sitting on either side of a fence having a conversation. And I knew where that fence was. I knew those two boys really shouldn't be there. They had no business being there. And I pretty much immediately sat down to start writing it. And I wanted to view it in the third person, to do it from Bruno's point of view, but from a slight distance as well as a narrator, but to only talk about those things, only recognise those things that a 9-year-old boy would. Therefore, the novel is a novel of misunderstandings and misperceptions. Where it came from, I don't quite know, because I think writers, when they write novels, an idea comes to you, and if it works, you start writing it, and it's one of those moments. But the difference between this book and anything I've written before it is that I wrote it in a very short space of time. I got into a tone of voice that seemed to take me over, and I knew that to step away from writing it until I got to the end, really, would be a mistake. One of the things I've liked since giving it to people to read has been when people have said they have read the book in one or two sittings, over a couple of hours maybe, and they started it and got straight to the end. Because that, in a way, is how I wrote it. I started it, and pretty much about a week and a half after I sat down to write the opening lines, you were reading it at your office in Oxford.
Do you think that somebody could say, well, it was so quick, that means it can't be any good?
While the initial draft was that, there was a year's worth of work that had to go into making this novel as good as it could possibly be. But even if I had never changed a word, even if I had written it in a few days, given it to you and you'd published it without changing a word, that wouldn't mean it wasn't any good. I think if a story comes to you, it comes to you. If you write it over 5 years or you write it over 5 days, if it works, it works. And I felt with the first draft, I felt I was onto something. I felt I had achieved something in that first draft, which I had never achieved in the final draft of anything I'd written before. And I thought I was ready to show somebody. At that point, I wanted some reaction. You know, I wanted somebody to read it and tell me they thought it was either great or dreadful.
OK, you know? Well, I'm going to ask you a question to which I should know the answer. But what was the reaction you got from your publisher? And how did you feel about it? It's quite interesting to ask this.
Before, of course, it went to you as a publisher, it went to my agent, who, of course, passed it along. And two agents read it at that time, one of whom was my own agent and one of whom was another agent. And the other agent was extremely negative about the book and felt that...
On what grounds?
I think her exact phrase was, it would not be something you would want your children to read. Now, that was something that didn't make any sense to me. Yes, this is a scary story. Yes, it deals with an awful situation that is going to cause parents and teachers to have to answer some difficult questions. Is that something, as parents and teachers, that we want to step away from? Do we only want to give our children books to read about, you know?
Well, I had the same. I had exactly the same response as you from the daughter of a survivor of Auschwitz, and she spoke to me about The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas and said she read it with an eye to thinking, should I show this to my children? And she came back with a resounding yes, affirmative.
That is a greater compliment to me, to hear that from someone who actually has a personal experience of it and feels the book has a validity. That means more to me and is more important to me than sort of anything else really that comes along with this. I felt it was a book that anybody could read, but I was particularly keen in the first instance that it would be read by children. And
do you think of it as a children's book?
No, I think of it as a book. I don't think of it as a children's book or an adult's book. I'm not entirely sure I know what the difference is between a children's book and an adult's book. You said to me at one point recently, you said, what's Treasure Island?
Yes.
Is it a children's book? No. Is it an adult's book? No, it's a book.
Yes.
It's a story. And the more I grow as a writer and the more I have conversations about writing with people like yourself, the more I learn about writing and realize that these distinctions, who are these distinctions for? You know who these distinctions are for? They're for bookshops. Do we put it in this, over on the left-hand side of the shop, which we call crime, or over on the right, which we call literary fiction?
You would know about this, John, because you were a bookseller, weren't you?
So. Yeah, I spent 7 years as a bookseller. And personally, I was always confused by a lot of the, particularly like within fiction, I mean, these distinctions between literary fiction and popular fiction and crime fiction and historical fiction. Mm. I mean, where do we draw the line? Fiction written by people 6 foot and over?
I always say that you don't hand in your reading passport at the age of 14 to draw an adult one, or the age of 12 or whenever. You seamlessly travel up the ladder, and every step you take frees your mind further, doesn't it?
As a reader, as opposed to a writer, over the last few years, and I'm 35 now, and I haven't read children's books, whatever, ostensibly children's books, since I was a child. But over the last few years, since getting involved, well, since writing this book, for example, and since reading things over the last few years, like Philip Pullman and like Mark Haddon's book, which opened my mind to the fact that actually there's a whole world of other writing going on out there that for some reason I'm ignoring. And over the last year, being involved in the children's publishing world in Britain with this book, I've had my eyes opened to a whole wealth of literature that for some reason I never read. Obviously, as a very keen reader who gets through a couple of books a week, it's suddenly very exciting to not be looking for the new Philip Roth or the new Anne Tyler, but to be looking for the new David Almond, or the new Michael Morpurgo, people who, ridiculously, I had simply stepped away from as an adult. You know, I want to read, in the same way that you say you want to publish stories, good stories, that's what I want to read.
The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas is being published as an adult novel.
Yeah.
What do you make of that? How does that stand up then? And how do you feel about that?
Well, I feel fine about it in the sense that as a writer, I want to have as many readers as possible. What this book has opened up to me is a younger audience as well as an older audience. So I really like that idea. As a publisher who is associated with children's books, doesn't the same question really can be turned on you, that how do you feel about a book that you published ostensibly as a children's book being published now as an adult book, when really the only difference between the adult book and the children's book is a different jacket? My business as a writer is to create a story and create characters and hopefully create a world that as a reader you will lose yourself in. When you sit down with a book, you're separating yourself out of your world for a few hours and getting lost in a story. That's my job. My job isn't to decide who should read it and who shouldn't read it. And I suppose because a lot of the foreign publishers, some of them are doing it initially as an adult book, some as a children's book, I'm getting asked the question a lot. And it seems to me to be a question for the people who make these decisions.
And not for story readers.
Not for story writers.
On that response by readers, has there been a different response from different countries as the book has been published in so many different places?
Well, so far, not really. So far, it's been very positive. I mean, it's come out, the original publication obviously was Britain and Australia and Ireland. So far, we're up to about 15 languages, and only the Dutch, Italian and Norwegian have been published as yet. And their response has not been dissimilar to the response here. There's a lot more countries to come, including Germany. There's America to come in September of this year, which is going to be very interesting to see what their response is, because obviously there's a huge Jewish community in America. Although I have to say, I do like to broaden it out that as the writer of this book, my personal relationship with this book isn't from being Jewish, it's from being a human being, that I hope that it would be read by people around the world of as many religious and ethnic orientations as possible. But I'll be very interested to see what the response is from people in America, particularly people who have unfortunately lost people during this time. But by the same token, I'll be very interested in the German reaction.
I've had a little bit of the German reaction. It's going to be published in Germany. And I think you get the same mixed reaction, overwhelmingly affirmative, but occasionally people being troubled and worried because of the sense of complacency.
Yeah, but I think that complacency is a valid argument to put forward. And also it is aimed at a generation who are no longer with us. People in Germany now obviously do not have to take responsibility for something that happened before they were born. That would be unfair. So that complacency is the complacency which can't, I don't think, be denied.
But you're respectful.
I don't think it's necessarily up to me, or I don't think you need me as such, to make moral judgments. There is really only one judgment that can come when, you know, a normal person reads or thinks about the subject matter of the Holocaust. And you don't need a writer of a novel to tell you what you should feel about it. So, you know, I didn't want to do that. I think that's pointless. Plus, because Bruno is a child, because he's the child of an important man in the Nazi party, I couldn't have a situation where Bruno himself was judging his father and condemning him. Because he's a child, he's going to love his father. It's a natural thing. But that doesn't mean that we don't read the book then and say, how could they do this? How could they even look at each other like this?
But won't some people, aren't some people angry because the father is made to be human at the end? He cares.
Well, if they're angry about that, that's, I think, a misreading of the book. The father obviously cares about his own son. If anything, I often think that the one thing I do to the father at the end of the book is I tell him, I show him what he's responsible for. It's a small moment, but that's a lot more than putting him in front of a firing squad or torturing him or something. To give him a moment where he realises what terrible acts he's responsible for, because for the first time, he's on the receiving end of it. Well, I mean, that's punishment, isn't it? If there can be punishment at all, you know, I mean, that's at least a small punishment.
John, do you think there are other lessons to be learned from Bruno's story?
Towards the end of the book, particularly on the very last page of the book, the way that I try to bring this story to a conclusion is by opening it up to other situations that have happened in the world in the 60 years in between 1945 and today. So in a way, this is a very large microcosm of a wider problem that goes on in the world. Now, we've seen genocides happen in Rwanda, in Kosovo. We've seen fences built in South Africa, in Northern Ireland. And those fences and those genocides sometimes being taken up by people in the world as a great cause and sometimes ignored. Now, as people and as political people in the world, we almost make decisions. Which problems are more important than others? Which genocides are more important than others?
So do you think that the story you've told can be applied to similar situations in the world that we live in now?
Yes, I think so. And that's actually one of the reasons why, after much discussion and much soul-searching on the subject, I decided not to use the word Auschwitz once within the book itself. By removing that word, even though we are clearly there, and even though all the signs are there through Bruno's misunderstandings that that's the camp we're in, by not specifically placing it there, it broadened it out that it could represent other camps of the time and other camps after that. And then that's reflected in that phrase which is used at the front of the book, which says, fences like this exist all over the world. We hope you never have to reach such a fence. That's aimed at people today. We hope you never have to reach such a fence.
John, I think that's a good note to finish on. Thank you very much
for
talking to us today.
The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas is published by Random House Audiobooks, a division of the Random House Group. Copyright John Boyne, 2006. Copyright and recording Random House Audiobooks. Published in hardback by David Fickling Books. John Boyne has asserted his right under the CDPA 1988 to be identified as the author of this work.
Hello, this is Jim Dale, narrator of the Harry Potter audiobook series. Listening to audiobooks isn't just great entertainment. It's also a great way for your family to experience and enjoy books together. Studies have shown that listening to stories read aloud helps children build vocabulary, improve their reading skills, and succeed more readily in school. It's an important step on the road to becoming a good reader, and one of the best ways to help ensure a lifelong love of literature for the children you care about. Check your local retailer for the wide selection of audiobooks available from Listening Library. Or if you would like to visit us online for more information, check our website at www.listeninglibrary.com. Thank you, and happy listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.